Mr. Mayor, see Reel 3.
Now, as I've just said, we were taken to Reggio Calabria at the toe of Italy, and there we were taken to the local station and waited on the platform. After half an hour or so, a train was brought up, and we were told to get into the train, and we, of course, did. We didn't know where we were being taken at that time. And then we got underway. Well, we hadn't been underway very long before the guards came round with our rations, and we were told that the trip would take 3 days and that we were being taken to a big army camp just south of Genoa. And we would be staying in the train the whole of the 3 days, and the rations were to last us for 3 days. Now, the rations consisted of 3 tins of mule meat, the tins being about the size of a tin of Heinz baked beans.
Did it say mule meat on the label?
No. That's what we were told that they were, and they were canned in 1937 because I saw 1937 imprinted on the can. And we were told that this was mule meat. And to be quite honest, it was quite tasty once we opened it. Anyway, the ration was 1 tin of this meat per day plus 2 biscuits. Now, the biscuits were something out of this world. Fantastic things. They were about 8 inches square and about 3/4 of an inch thick. And we had 2 of these per day. But the trouble was, when we came to eat them, it was well nigh impossible. You just couldn't break them. You needed a hammer to break them. Just imagine about 40 prisoners of war in a carriage which had wooden seats, and they were all bashing these biscuits on the wooden seats to try and get them down to manageable proportions to eat them with the mule meat. However, that's what we had to do. And every so often, the guards would come round with billy cans or fannies of fresh water to give us a drink. We never had any wine or coffee or anything like that, just pure water. Eventually, after 3 days, we did indeed arrive at a little town called Chiavari, about 20 kilometres south of Genoa. We were then put into lorries and taken about 15 kilometres up the valley of Lavagna to this big army camp, which, for the sake of authenticity, I will put into its Italian. It was called Campo Concentramento, Prigionieri di Guerra, numero 52. Now, I'll spell all that out for you later on. But it was prisoner of war concentration camp number 52. That's what it meant. Now, this camp housed about 3,500 personnel, and they were very nearly all army personnel from North Africa, the North African campaigns. And a large majority of them were South Africans and Afrikaans. There was a smattering of New Zealanders and a smattering of British Tommies. The only sailors in the camp were us when we arrived. We were allocated huts, and we were each given a dixie, which held about 2.5 pints of water. That was for our stew every day. And we were given a spoon and a fork. Knives were forbidden. You were not allowed a knife. Then we settled in to camp life as best we could. Our rations were mainly one Dixie full of a vegetable stew every day. Sometimes it had meat in, sometimes it didn't. And a pane, or a little loaf of bread, as I've already described earlier, about the size of one of our English penny buns. It was 120 grams, I think. Now, this pane, or little loaf of bread, was made from chestnut flour, and it was really delicious, and it was baked by the peasants in the valley. They used to bake it in earthenware ovens, and it used to be brought in sacks every morning for we prisoners. And it really was very tasty. Now, the valley of Lavagna, running up from Chiavari, is forested mainly with sweet chestnut trees. And this is where they got their flour from. They collected the chestnuts every year, ground them down into flour, and made their bread from them. We got in this camp for the first time Red Cross parcels. And one can imagine the delight of people such as I in those circumstances when we were handled 11 pounds of Red Cross parcel. Sometimes we got English ones, sometimes we got Canadian ones. And strangely enough, and dare I say it, we preferred the Canadian ones to the English ones.
Why was that?
Because they had more dried milk in. They had a pound tin of Klim milk, which we could make a lot of things with. And also, they had more chocolate in. I think there was a half a pound in the Canadian Red Cross parcel and a quarter of a pound in the English Red Cross parcel. On top of that, the biscuits were of a larger quantity. We got tins of fish, salmon in particular, a larger quantity of sugar, and a larger quantity of tea. In other words, the main difference between the English and the Canadian parcels was that although they both weighed the same in weight, that is 11 pounds each, the English Red Cross parcels had more of smaller quantities of stuff in than the Canadian ones, which had less and more quantities. For instance, in the English Red Cross parcels, you got tins of sardines, you got custard powder, you got tins of bacon, you got sugar, salt, pepper, and things like Yorkshire puddings. Well, in this camp that we were in, no fuel was issued out to cook anything. We had no means of cooking anything, so we had to set to and do what we called tin bashing. In other words, empty tins were made into cooking stoves. And so it was virtually impossible to cook things like Yorkshire puddings and make custard powders, because we just didn't have the milk to make custard powders. We did get a tin of Nestle's milk. That was very handy. You could sit down and eat that with a spoon. Just the job. We also got tins of jam. We were not supposed to have knives, so presumably you couldn't spread jam on a slice of pane or anything. But we didn't have knives. We made them. We found bits and pieces of metal. I made one myself and one for my mucker in. But as I say, the main difference between the English parcels and the Canadians was that the English had more of smaller quantities than the Canadians did. And we preferred the Canadian ones, really. Anyway, one of these parcels was dished out between two men twice a week. So that in actual fact, you had half a parcel twice a week. Now, I'm going to say, in all sincerity, now, that if we had not had Red Cross parcels in that camp, I would not be sitting here today talking into this microphone and making these tape recordings, because they were lifesavers to us. And one of my favourite charities has always been, and has got to be, the Red Cross. So if anyone is listening to this, please take note of what I've said. I'm not trying to push them in any way, but I wouldn't be here if it were not for the Red Cross and their food parcels during the war.
You were saying that one of the nationalities who were imprisoned with you were the South Africans. How did you get on with them?
Not very well, particularly the Afrikaans. Dare I say, they were a filthy crowd.
In what way?
Hygienically, health-wise. They didn't keep themselves clean, washed. They didn't keep their clothes clean. And in this camp was the one and only place where we came across lice. Now, as I said before, there were not many British Tommies there. They had got lice, and they used to hang their shirts and shorts and one thing and the other out on bits of wire and try and get rid of them and wash them and that sort of thing. The Afrikaans and the South Africans, they didn't bath or wash themselves very much, particularly the Afrikaans. At night before we were locked up, we all obviously went to the toilets, which were overflowing with urine. The South Africans and Afrikaans had bare feet. They used to paddle around in all the urine, come back straight into the hut and jump on their bunk. That's the sort of carry-on that we had to cope with this lot. I remember one morning, about 8 o'clock, in my hut, the canteen representative came round taking orders for the canteen. And there was a South African there by the name of, he was a sergeant, his name was Pinkerton, Sergeant Pinkerton. He was a big chap, about 6 foot tall. And I ordered 3 boxes of matches from the canteen. Immediately, he started to lash into me verbally, accusing me of trying to corner the market in matches. Well, I saw red, so I laid into him, and there was a fight.
A physical fight?
Yes, a physical fight. And we were hauled apart and calmed down. Now, I've just said that I was accused of cornering the market in matches. I said earlier on that no fuel was allowed to us, no form of cooking apparatus whatsoever. So every piece of wood, little tiny pieces of bark, twigs, matches, anything that would burn was precious for the stoves that we made out of the empty tins. And also to produce charcoal for the fan blowers which we developed, about which I'll talk later on. And that's why matches were precious, not just for lighting things, but for the wood content. Now, in this camp, during the summer, we used to be taken for walks about 3 kilometres up the road to a little village called Chikanya, which incidentally is where Columbus was born, or about 3 kilometres down the valley the other way to a little village called Calvary. Now, during these walks was a golden opportunity to fill up our bags, haversacks, what have you, with chips of wood, twigs, small branches, anything in the wood line that would burn. We could take back to camp to fuel our stoves with for cooking purposes. So, while we were on the march, we used to fill up our haversacks with these bits and pieces to do our cooking with.
Apart from the problems with the South Africans about hygiene, I was going to ask you if the South Africans got on with the Italians in exactly the same way that the British got on with the Italians, or was there a different relationship between the South Africans and the Italians?
Well, it's funny that you should ask this question, because this is exactly what happened. We found that the Italians, and Afrikaans in particular, became quite friendly with the Carabinieri and the Italian guards, which we didn't go much on at all, because this could be dangerous. When it came to people making plans to escape, word could be carried to the ears of the Carabinieri, or if you had something like a knife, which you were not supposed to have, this could be told to the Carabinieri. Every so often, they raided us, looking for knives. Radio sets didn't come into it in this particular camp. We just couldn't make them because we couldn't get hold of the stuff. It was as simple as that. So, you know, the South Africans and Afrikaans in particular were a danger in this way, and we didn't like this. This was one of the things that we held against them.
Why do you think that they got on better with the Carabinieri?
I don't know. Nobody could ever sort of understand it, you know. I just don't know why they seem to get on better, but they seem to go out of their way to be friendly to them. Whereas the rest of us, of course, were quite the reverse. Well, now, following on from that, were you just going to say something?
Well, I was going to ask if you ever had any specific reason to suspect any particular South
Africans.
Well,
we did, and I was just going to bring this up, actually, following on from that. I'd only been in the camp 3 weeks, and the chap below me was an RAF sergeant by the name of Gordon Felber, and I was always talking about wanting to escape. He'd heard me talking. One day when we were out in the compound, he came up to me and he said, "Do you really mean that you want to escape if you can?" I said, "Yes, of course I do, and I want to stick here." So he said, "Right, well, I'll take a chance." He said, "There is a tunnel being dug." And he said, "It's from Hut 41, just up there. And there are about 40 of us involved in it. And it's being dug from the farther end of the hut, under the wire, out into a maize field, which was the other side of the wire." He said, "Would you like to be included?" So I said, "Yes, please." Well, now, I was included in the numbers to make the break when the tunnel was done. But I was not included as among those helping to dig it. Well, now, about 4 or 5 weeks later, suddenly the guards poured into the camp one morning. They were searching under the huts, and eventually they found the tunnel under Hut 41. And we strongly suspected an informer. And we strongly suspected an Afrikaner.
Why did you suspect him?
Because he was friendly with the guards, very friendly with the guards, the Carabinieri mostly. And, you know, it seemed to point that way. So, as I say, that was discovered. Now, going back to talking about these walks that we had, I'm getting a bit disjointed here, perhaps, but I've just been talking about this tunnel. Well, this didn't put me off escaping. And I fell in with an RASC sergeant and a lance corporal. We used to mooch around the compound talking. The subject of escaping came up. And they said, "Are you interested?" So I said, "Well, yes, of course I am." So they said, "Right. That'll be three of us then." Now, the RASC sergeant had been out on working parties in the valley. And while he was out on one of these working parties, he met a young Italian woman who, strangely enough, he'd known in Cairo before the war, and they recognised each other. And apparently they got talking, and she said that she lived just half a mile up the road from the camp, and they got round to talking about escaping. So she said that she would help him. So he said, well, he'd got a friend. I wasn't involved at that time. He got a friend who wanted to go with him. So she said, all right, if you can get out of the camp, I will help you. Well, then, as I say, I was talking to these two chaps and they included me. Well, now, the plan was that when we went out on these walks, we would take with us civilian clothes, which we get one way or the other. And when we went up to Chicania, there was a church there with three confessional boxes in it. And the idea was that while we were in the church being shown around by the guards, they were very proud of this church for some reason or other, we would each slip into a confessional box. Once the prisoners and the guards had left the church and gone outside, we'd do a quick change into our civvy clothes and come out of the church when they'd left, hoping that they wouldn't be counted and therefore our absence be discovered so soon. And alongside the church were piles of faggots. Now, we'd noticed that when we went out on these walks, we used to pass peasants quite often with one or two of these faggots slung across their back, walking up the road towards the village or away from the church. And the idea was that we would change into a sort of peasant costume in the confessional boxes. We would come out. We would pick up these faggots. We would walk up the road into an orange grove over the top of a small hill. Once in there, then the chap who knew this girl would go down at night to where she lived, tell her where we were, that there were three of us, and she could get cracking. And what she was going to do, and what in fact she did do, was to get a boat on the beach at Chiavari and load it up with food and water. Now, this boat apparently, I discovered all this later, this boat had an engine, and the Lance Corporal was a mechanic. The RASC chap, he'd been used to sailing, so he could sail a boat. And I, in my job on the plot, was used to navigating, so I could do a bit of navigating. So we were well covered whichever way we went. Navigation, sailing, power, all covered. Well, we started to get our clothes together and our rations, which consisted of tins of Nestle's milk and chocolate in the main. And we used to go sunbathing down the farther end of the camp in the nude every afternoon so that we could get nice and brown all over and look the part of an Italian peasant for this job. We got into August of July of August 1943, and it was decided that we would make a break for it if there was a walking party on the 23rd of August. I forget which day of the week it was, but that's when we were going to make a break. Everything was prepared. The RASC chap had heard from this girl that the boat was at Chiavari, ready and waiting. And then, as you may remember, the Italians decided to surrender in August 43. Well, shortly before that surrender took place, they decided that they were going to shift a lot of prisoners of war into factories up in northern Italy. And the two chaps who I was going to make a break with were two of those that were shifted from the camp. And they were taken to a factory in Milan, as far as I could find out. My contact with the outside world was gone. I was finished. I couldn't do a thing except bemoan the fact that that escape was down the drain, or the possibility of, and just eat my chocolate and tins of condensed milk and make the best of a bad job.
You mentioned earlier that the Italians refused to allow you knives, and I wondered if this was because of the fear that some people might commit suicide, and that raised the question of the, in my mind, of the morale of people in the camp.
No, I don't think it was from that angle at all. I don't think it was any question of people committing suicide. It was a question, I think, mainly of the fact that we might use knives on the guards, more than us committing suicide. I think that was the real reason.
So what was morale like?
Morale in the camp, really, all things considered, was quite good. You've got to remember, I suppose, that most of the people in that particular camp had not been prisoners of war very long. So they hadn't sort of had too long to sit down and bewail the fact that they were prisoners of war and in a rough old condition. They could still cope pretty well. They hadn't got to the stage where they would sit on their bunk and just stare into space with glassy eyes with no interest in anything at all. The facilities in the camp were not very good. As I've already mentioned, what lengths we had to go to cook anything.